Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, it feels like we're getting back to a classic Cinema Clash episode. We've got the big ones, and we've got the little ones.
And we have the biggest one that somebody missed.
But first, I did get, we've had a bad run of wine lately. And I took a little special care with this
you
one.
You did. I'm impressed. It's called Ali, and it's a wine from Tuscany, I believe. And it's a red, and it's actually very good. And I am assuming that you picked this one because of Ali, Prince Ali, perhaps, from Aladdin?
Well, I saw the bottle, and I assume it's pronounced Ali, but
it A-L-I.
Think of Prince Ali, yes, it is he, Ali. I remember seeing that when it came out in 1992, when I was 11 or 12, whatever part of the year that came out. I remember I liked it very much. It ingrained itself in the Disney canon. Everyone liked the Blue Genie and Princess Jasmine and the bird Iago. And I was fine with that, so I felt no need to see it again.
You enjoyed it so much that you absolutely refused to diminish your memory of the original, which is a shame because you actually missed quite a decent flick.
I'm sure they did not make it better.
No, they didn't make it better. It's different, and yet it is faithful
but
to
I've seen the
story,
am I correct?
You have seen the story, but you had seen the story of Cinderella before the live-action remake.
I didn't see that one either.
You had seen the story of Beauty and the Beast before the live-action remake.
Which is why I wanted to scoop out my eyeballs.
You may go see The Lion King.
No, I won't.
And I think this movie will help. I think it will actually help
Disney's pocketbook.
No, but I think it will help influence people like you who are so skeptical about these live-action remakes that the buzz from this one, from Aladdin, will be strong enough that people will feel like, well, maybe the Lion King will manage to kind of keep that.
Have you already
going.
Forgotten Dumbo?
No, Dumbo sucked. So this was a this was a huge relief, and that's the thing is I went into this new live action Aladdin with the lowest of expectations and very skeptical because it's true that nobody can be a better genie than Robin Williams.
Well, that's what everybody wants to know. How is Will Smith as the genie?
Will Smith as the big blue wisecracking genie is fine. He's not as... He's channeling Robin Williams. He's trying...
Is he copycatting?
He's not copycatting completely. There are definitely elements of him trying to leverage what Robin Williams was able to bring to that role. But Robin Williams was a master of ad-lib, and so it doesn't have that free-flowing craziness that that Robin Williams was able to bring to it. But then this isn't just strictly a Will Smith movie. Will Smith is the headliner. He's the one that the biggest name, but he's the weakest voice of the bunch. And if they had not been able to find two decent actors and singers for the roles of Aladdin and Princess Jasmine, it would be a completely different story. But it's because the Aladdin and Jasmine characters are fun enough to watch and are good enough. It's Mina Massoud plays the charming street urchin Aladdin. And then Naomi Scott, who's a British-born actress and singer, is Princess Jasmine, and they are both very endearing, very watchable, very strong. Naomi Scott's by far the strongest singer. She's got that bring down the house power number that's new. So while, yes, it's great to hear, you'll never have a friend like me.
Well, are we on a magic carpet ride singing about a whole new world?
We are absolutely on a cool new magic carpet ride singing a whole new world. But there's this song called Speechless that I think you will very possibly hear again come award season in the mix for Best Original Song, because it's just one of those designed to be Oscar bait, power ballad, girl power song. It's that breakout number that Naomi Scott gets as Princess Jasmine when she is kind of showing her leadership skills and determination. And so I think that that's going to be something that kind of sticks with people in this new version. And it was just a pleasant surprise. You know, you would, even going into it as sort of angry as you might be, I still think at some point you should give it a shot.
I've given some of these a shot. I kind of enjoyed The Jungle Book.
I did not like
Beauty and the Beast.
I liked Beauty and the Beast.
Dumbo was atrocious.
And Dumbo was terrible. But this is a redemption, I think, because, yes, I was so concerned after being so disappointed with Dumbo that this new Aladdin is for people who like movie musicals. And so I'm a sucker for that genre.
How do you get past the cynicism? Why don't they create a new musical?
But 1992, this is a new version for
new generation. Scenes. It's the same scenes.
It's going to appeal on a different level as a family-friendly film. You have to remember that 1992's Aladdin was this animated G-rated movie. This is a PG-rated live action, slightly darker, too long. It definitely goes too long. It's a smidge over 2 hours, which for a kids movie, I think is too long. But among the kids who were there at the screening, they all actually stayed with it pretty well. And you would have hated it from the get-go, because before we actually got to the movie, you had about 10 minutes of trailers for Frozen 2. Followed by Toy Story 4. Mm. And so everything old is new again, or is being
being recycled to wring even more money out of the rag.
But it's because there is good raw material. And so when you actually have...
There's nothing raw about it.
They're
polishing and polished.
But the same reason that Beauty and the Beast worked, and Cinderella worked as live action, is why Aladdin works too, is that it still delivers just some solid entertainment and good music, and you get a bit of the nostalgia factor, because I'm not going to go back and watch the animated Aladdin anytime soon from 1992. You know, times change and production values change, and so they're able to take advantage of some things that you wouldn't have been able to take advantage of in the past. The production design is really vibrant and cool. Guy Ritchie directs this, which is very unusual. You wouldn't necessarily think of Guy Ritchie directing a Disney live action version of an animated classic. I think he pulled it off.
You talk about change. There is a change. There used to be pride in originality, pride in creativity. Now it's just, ho-hum, let's remake this one
next.
But
you're not allowed to diss it if you haven't seen it.
Sure I can. I have seen it. I've seen it.
You haven't seen,
I have seen it.
This version.
I know exactly what happens.
And so,
I can tell you the plot right now.
It's not about the plot. It's about...
I know who wins.
For the same reason you watch... But haven't you seen Aladdin multiple times?
I know 95% of the dialogue.
Have you seen it multiple times?
I'm sure I have.
Exactly. So what's the difference?
I've seen it.
But you've seen it. Why see it? But you've seen it again and again and again. So here's another version that I think people
will likely see it again. I can't believe you're defending this multinational jaded corporation who's just taking their entire back catalog and hitting the reset button.
I can't believe that you would just dismiss it without having seen it.
I've seen the 7 previous transformations.
No, I don't think you have. I don't think it counts that way. It's a different interpretation, a different stylization of the story.
Yes, they took the cartoon off and put him in a studio.
And you have fresh new faces who are singing these older songs and bringing them, I think, to a new generation.
Fresh Prince
and
indeed.
And I think you will see this being one of those ones. It's sort of like The Greatest Showman that's going to have a divide.
Oh, like an original movie.
But there's going to be this divide between people who just like a movie musical and who don't overanalyze it.
I'm not overanalyzing it. The Greatest Showman, I hadn't heard any of those songs before. I hadn't seen that story before. I hadn't even seen a movie about P.T. Barnum before.
But
how can you compare this to The Greatest Showman?
Because it's the kind of movie that a lot of people did not like, and yet it has like this whole...
Who didn't like The Greatest
there
Showman?
There were plenty of people who didn't like it.
Revisionist history.
But because the story of The Greatest Showman, the story's not that great. The songs are what makes that movie. The
songs are great.
Exactly. And so in this,
it made $1 billion.
And this is the songs... And the old songs and the new songs combined are what's going to make this potential for repeat viewing. It's going to be one of those ones that people who have seen it before are going to like see that it's playing on an airplane or see it streaming. And they're just going to stop and watch because they're going to enjoy the music that they enjoy the same way they enjoyed it in 1992 and beyond. This is a way for them to enjoy it again and potentially enjoy it with a whole new set of people, a new generation of kids.
You are an apologist.
No.
You're softy. You're vanilla ice cream.
You are a cynic. You are a cynic and a skeptic who has no right to diss something that he has not seen.
But I have seen it.
You have
it's
not
It's crazy
seen it.
How I've seen this and can... I know the movie.
We could go around in circles on that one, but let's move on.
Perhaps the best film. Let's talk about the best film of the week. And it's called Booksmart. We've seen the genre. Nowadays, every year, about May, the graduating seniors of high school get a film. I had one in 1998. I had Can't Hardly Wait, starring Jennifer Love Hewitt. It takes place in one night. Anything that can happen will. Crushes are achieved. Crushes are quashed. Parties are debaucherous. It all stems from American Graffiti. They're kind of just remaking American Graffiti when they do all of these. The year after Can't Hardly Wait, the seniors had American Pie. Last year, they had Blockers, and it was so transformational because now you had three females making a Let's Lose Our Virginity pact. Now you have Booksmart, this year's graduating senior film, where the two girls make a pact to make up for 4 years of studying. They discovered... We studied, but we could have partied. We got into great colleges. We got into Yale. We got into Columbia. Like we planned. We studied. We didn't go out. We didn't hang out. We didn't have any friends. We didn't go to homecoming. We didn't go to prom. We studied. And what Molly learns, played by Beanie Feldstein, the valedictorian and class president, is everyone else got into top universities as well, and they had a pretty good time. She feels this is the night before high school graduation. My best friend, Amy... played by Caitlin Dever, you and me, we're going out tonight. We're dressing up. We're going to find the party. We're both going to reveal ourselves to our crushes, and we are making up for what we missed.
Well, I think with all of your examples, you just undermined your previous Aladdin argument where you're saying that just like all these other movies have done and where there is a new twist on the same story, and that's what it is. But
I've never seen Booksmart before.
It's still very good.
I didn't know the jokes.
But it's a gender flip super bad and without as much raunch.
It is. I can see this getting easily pigeonholed as the female Superbad, and they are very similar films. They're raunchy. Beanie Feldstein is Jonah
raunchy.
Hill's sister in real life. There is a familial connection. This is raunchy.
It's not nearly as raunchy.
No, it's not Superbad raunchy, but it is over the line, as it should be.
It's rated R, and so things are exaggerated, and things don't make all that much sense in some ways, but it's still a smart and entertaining movie. And my point is just that you can kind of do a twist on a story you've seen before.
There was no twist in Aladdin.
And there is. How would you know? You didn't see it.
Oh my God. You're right. We're going round and round.
Yes.
We're never going to get past
this. Booksmart, I did enjoy. It's definitely for the older crowd, though, for older kids, or not even, you know, high school. They need to be high school age. But also, this is Olivia Wilde, the actress's her directorial debut, and she did a really good job for her first directing. I still see her as 13 on the TV series House.
A lot of people know Olivia Wilde more than I do. I've never seen The O.C. I've never seen House. I know her as the like robot sidekick in Tron Legacy.
Oh, and I have to still try and forgive her for the Lazarus effect. Remember that one?
That was, she in that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Really bad. But she does really well. But no, she was always, I think, probably, she really broke out in House as this resident who House referred to as 13. But she does very well in this. And I watched an interview with her where she really talked about how she wanted to make a movie that reminded her of the movies that she loved in her youth, that made her want to go into show business. And those were movies like Dazed and Confused, The Breakfast Club, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Clueless.
You know, I saw that quote and then I realized this movie is nothing like Ridgemont High or Clueless. Those were not one night films.
No, but tonally, I think they're teen films that she felt that speak to that generation, speak to the kids, and speak to the youth and have some ultimate positivity in their themes, even though often delivered in a somewhat raunchy way.
Booksmart is more slapstick, more one-liner than those a little bit more complete films. It's a very, very good film.
Yeah, I don't know.
But it's more punchy.
I disagree. I think it's, I could see how what she was doing was in that same vein. And also, the filmmakers they took inspiration also from things like the buddy cop movies, like Beverly Hills Cop.
I don't even see
and
that at
all. I do, in Lethal Weapon. It's because the two girls have each other.
They're friends, yes, they're friends.
But they're going to have each other's backs, even when things aren't necessarily going according to plan. And hey, I'm just saying, this is what
and it's funny how actually they bring that out.
This is what they're saying that they use as inspiration. In addition to your female friendship movies like A Bridesmaid.
Well, when they want to get each other's attention, they will just say Malala. And you're like, oh, she means business. She brought up Malala.
I mean, it's a smart code word. It's pretty funny.
And I would actually say this is not a coming of age story. They studied through that. They're already of age. They actually have to demature. They have to get younger to survive this night.
Yeah, it's a coming of age story with a significant twist.
And the supporting characters, which usually make a film like this, are not as one dimensional as they usually are. Yes, each one kind of, you know, you got the theater geek and the skater chick, but they're actually a little bit more composite than normal. I appreciate that. Jason Sudeikis popped up, and I didn't know why. Now I know why.
Yeah, him and Olivia
Wilde are affianced.
Oh, yeah.
And they have two children together. I had no idea about that.
Yeah. No, and did you know that Mason Gooding, do you know who?
He's Nick, the vice president.
Yeah.
I don't know
Cuba
who he is.
Gooding Jr.'s son.
They not look alike.
I know.
They do not look alike.
He's also in. But the scene stealer, for sure, is Billie Lourd.
Oh, who plays really?
Gigi. And she's just this quirky, omnipresent. I mean, her role is bizarre. She provides the
bizarre,
offbeat comic relief. Anytime things start to get kind of heavy, she'll just sort of pop up in the scene. And so it's a comic relief kind of bizarro role.
I actually liked her brother. I don't know how to say it, but Skylar Gisondo. We saw him in the remake of National Lampoon's Vacation where Ed Helms was Clark Griswold. I think he was Rusty the son because I recognized him when he popped up and he is funny. I really got a lot of chuckles out of him.
Well, and Jason Sudeikis is in it. We already said that. That's Wilde's significant other. But who was I thinking of the other Saturday Night Live guy? Will Forte and Lisa Kudrow.
Very briefly.
They're very brief, but they're funny in their moment playing Amy's parents. And they're trying to be these very supportive, woke parents. And they're very funny. And then it made me think of, I was like, what movie was Lisa Kudrow in where she was like going to her high school reunion?
Romy.
And it was like, oh, yes, Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. And so I just think it was kind of fun to just sort of revisit Lisa Kudrow in a high school type of graduation movie. And so it was all in all, it's a smart and entertaining film.
It's better than last year's Blockers. It's probably the funniest film released this year. It really is funny, and it's deeper. They actually have some issues to confront and challenges to overcome, and I appreciated that. Yeah, this is a very funny film, and what I believe is the best film this week.
It's the best film for an R-rated film that you're not going to go with the whole family, but it's Memorial Day weekend, and people that are going for family-friendly fare to the theater, they're all going to go see Aladdin. But for the gal pals, like, I would love seeing this with, like, my high school friends and going back a few decades. And it reminded me a little bit, like, I had my best friend in high school and we were inseparable. And so this kind of brought back some of that nostalgia, which was nice. And just makes you think, you know, what if you had a do-over? And heck, did I not party enough? Did you strike that right balance in high school between partying and studying, and really, did any of it make a difference in your ultimate path?
Well, someone online pointed out that Booksmart predicted the controversy of parents, rich parents, buying their children spots at prestigious schools, which is most likely how most of these kids got into those schools.
Oh, I don't know. Like,
that's very sharp.
I don't think so. I think they're trying to say
Nick, the vice president, was that good to get into Georgetown?
He got into Stanford on a lacrosse
scholarship. No, that was his friend. But
that's the other friend who got it? Oh, I thought Nick got into it.
No, this just reeks of, actually, that's how people got into Stanford. They were on the crew team, but they never did crew.
But the whole point of this film is that Amy and Molly didn't really know their classmates all that well, and they were prejudging them.
No, especially Molly. She looked down upon them. She condescended to them.
Right.
And what made her happy was that she was going to a prestigious university at the expense of her peers who partied. It made her happy to know that they were going to fail.
Yeah, but she didn't know them all that well, and so she was missing something. She wasn't seeing them completely because she was just so concerned with hitting the books and being so sure that's what she needed to do in order to just get where she wants to go, which is ultimately to become a Supreme Court justice someday. So, you know, good on her. And again, it's a fun way to kind of tell that kind of story, and that it's not just your typical high school raunch. It is better than Blockers for sure.
Absolutely. Now's that part of the episode where we talk about the French film. you and me, even talking about French films, have talked about the director Olivier Assayas twice.
I have.
On this show.
Are you sure?
We talked about Clouds of Sils Maria.
Which only you saw.
And I thought you were there.
No,
and we talked about Personal Shopper.
I did see Personal Shopper with Kristen Stewart.
Kristen Stewart. Mm-hmm. He's back. He made another one. It's called Nonfiction. In France, it's called Double Vie, Double Lives, which is the far better title once you see the film. It's about the Parisian elite. They're all, you know, in their salon, drinking red wine, and they are discussing literature, the publishing world, how ebooks and the digital transformation are going to blow a hole in what we know as literature. And of course, the main couple, Juliette Binoche, Selena, she's an actress in the film, breaks the fourth wall a couple times, which is kind of funny. And Guillaume Canet plays her husband. Of course, they're sleeping with other people. It's French.
It's very French.
Right? They don't, you know, admit that to each other, but and one of them, you know, they're not really sure, but they kind of suspect the other one's also sleeping with someone else. But yeah, they both have their paramours, their illicit paramours, and this is a film that he just had dialogue. Assayas just had dialogue to get down, and it's witty, it's intriguing. But he said, "How do I get this dialogue into a film?" He's like, "All right, I'll put some adultery in there. I'll put some Paris stuff in there. I'll make her an actress." But really, it's all, let me get these dialogue scenes in there. It's not great. It's not Personal Shopper. It's not Clouds of Sils Maria. This is a minor Assayas. It's not going to win anything. It will be forgotten, but I'll take it.
Well, I think that Artie Chick, who reviewed it for Chick Flicks, because it was definitely always going to be an Artie film. And so because I was seeing something like Aladdin that was going to be the biggest movie of the week, I skipped Nonfiction because it just didn't really appeal to me. But Artie Chick liked it. She thought it was very smart and entertaining, and that she seemed to have looked at it through a slightly different lens than you, that she didn't think that the literature part was definitely secondary, and that whole the Parisian scene was secondary to the relationships and to the, you know, to that Juliette Binoche's character's seductive aura and things that were going on with her and with all these affairs. And so she, you know, so Artie Chick, I think, liked it more than you did. So I'm just saying there might be a slightly different way that the women, that the Artie crowd women are going to watch it versus the Artie crowd men like yourself.
Well, the women and characters in the film are actually a bit more secondary than the men. The men are a little bit more center stage. Guillaume Canet's friend is the writer, the novelist, Leonard Spiegel, played by Vincent McCain. He is funny. Assayas build this as a comedy. It's actually not that funny, but the comedic bits come at his expense. He's written a lot, but he's really not well known, and his books don't sell very well. And he says, "I am not a novelist. I write auto-fiction, autobiography fiction. So I use what I do in my life, and I expand upon that." And that becomes actually contentious in there. That's a big theme. How can you use other people's lives? And did you ask them? His ex-wife says she feels raped because he took things about her and put it in a novel, and the character's obviously her, and how dare he? And he becomes this actually this scandal, and you know, people make fun of him a lot, and he never really defends himself. So he's the comic, you know, just goofball who may or may not be sleeping with Juliette Binoche, which is hard to believe. But yeah, it is minor Assayas.
Well, and I was just not a huge fan of Personal Shopper, certainly not as much as you. So
oh, I love that movie.
That kind of that sort of was the
I'm in the majority on that. Like, Can agreed with me on that.
No, one. I mean, I think the art house crowd agrees with you on that one, and I think Christian Hammaker probably agreed with you on that one.
That was his favorite film of the year.
Yeah, so I didn't hate Personal Shopper; I just didn't particularly like it. And so this director's style is just not my cup of tea. So if you like his stuff, you'll probably like this one at least okay.
Yeah, fair enough. I also saw another one without you. This is The Documentary.
I lived through it.
It'd be even better if this was the French documentary, but it's not. It's just The Documentary. You know, mainstream audiences love when something is narrated by Morgan Freeman. I can't do a Morgan Freeman, but they just eat it up. Art house crowds love it when something is narrated by Werner Herzog. I love when Werner Herzog narrates a film. And he co-directs and narrates this, and he's interviewing somebody. He interviews Mikhail Gorbachev 3 times over the period of 6 months. And it's kind of chronological. Where were you born? How was your early life? How did you rise to power? You know, what are you proud of? What do you regret? And Gorbachev, still alive, not necessarily a spry 87. He is ailing, but he's still around and lucid. Gives a good interview. He was not, you know, a silver spoon apparatchik's son. He came up from nothing, just in the middle of nowhere. Farmer's kid who was very adept at the combine harvester and just was very interested in solving problems. You know, he went and got a law degree, wanted to make agriculture better. He was not one of these guys who lusted for power to go get fancy suits and fancy vodka at the expense of the serfs. No, he wanted to make life for the ordinary Russian better. And there's these wonderful pictures we've never seen and this video archival footage we've never seen, which just fascinated me. It's not the most engrossing film ever because, you know, especially if you remember it, you're not going to learn anything.
Yeah, it's what Artie Chick reviewed this one as well because she is a huge Werner Herzog fan. And so as soon as I saw that this was a Werner Herzog film, I knew that I would leave it to her. And I might try and catch up with it at some point because I remember the Gorbachev years and Perestroika. And you know, it was a very exciting time. And so I'm curious to potentially eventually see Meeting Gorbachev. But since I wasn't necessarily going to learn anything all that new. But I think what Artie Chick said was that it makes it, you just sort of walk away with a greater appreciation of him and maybe even some true sense of, wow, he was a great world leader, the kind of world leaders that wouldn't it be nice to have those kinds of world leaders again.
Yeah, you and had that, Gorbachev. Yeah. There's a big segment of Gorbachev and Thatcher. Thatcher mm-hmm. actually gets more time in the film than Reagan does. And what really, I think, will shock and surprise Western audiences is Gorbachev is reviled in Russia. They hate him. He's a traitor. He gave away the Soviet Union. He gave away Germany and let them reunify and tear down the wall in the Eastern Bloc. Go away. What I came away from this film is, in the long arc of history, not this just the decade long of history, but the long arc of history, Gorbachev is going to win history, Russian history, late 20th century history. Putin's going to lose. He's temporarily popular in Russia with his fake bravado, bare-chested, bear-riding dude.
Gosh, remind you of anyone?
Gorbachev is going to win.
I hope so.
Not
and
in
I
his lifetime.
Should. Sure. I mean, history will, that's the beauty of history. But I heard that there is no real mention of Putin in this movie.
He alludes to him. His name is not. He never says his name because he, you know, doesn't want to get murdered in,
right.
as 87 year. But he says it in all but name that today's leadership is corrupt. And at the expense of the Russian, he blatantly says that.
Well, and I think that extends to the current political climate, unfortunately, on a much larger scale. So, you know, I was doing news. I remember during 1989 with the fall of the wall. And I mean, it was just a very just transitional, cool time in history. And even just I'm glad that Gorbachev is kind of getting his due, and that there's a reminder that's being put out there about the sacrifices. I mean, he had to sacrifice. He had to take some huge political and personal risks to make the choices that he did that I think ultimately will be seen as being for the greater good.
Yeah, he was the kind of politician you hope politicians are. Mm-hmm. He cared about the people he was serving. Yes, he was serving them as the general secretary of the Communist Party, but it's either that or nothing, right? So He was trying to solve their problems, something that politicians don't really do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, unfortunately, it is not going to be one of the year's greatest documentaries, but it's, I appreciate any Herzog, as many of us art house aficionados do.
Yep, sounds good.
Our last film I didn't want to watch, because I've seen it.
And it's not Aladdin.
It's not Aladdin. What was that called? It was
The Catcher Was a Spy.
It starred Paul Rudd. I remember we said he was seriously miscast as the catcher Mo Berg, who went during World War II after his Boston Red Sox career to check out the German nuclear enterprise. And now is you shot me the link, so I ended up watching the documentary version of it, The Spy Behind the Plate.
The Spy Behind Home Plate.
And actually, it's pretty darn good.
Oh, see, I thought it was kind of, I don't know, a little dry. It made me realize why, and this was written, produced, and directed by a local filmmaker, Aviva Kempner, who's probably best known for really promoting, putting out there the information about another Jewish sports hero, Hank Greenberg, and she did The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg. So she likes to put the spotlight on sometimes these little-known Jewish heroes, which is great. This is the first full-length feature documentary about Mo Berg, and then you have this fictionalized version that came out last year or 2 years ago, whenever it was. And I remember feeling after watching the Paul Rudd version that it's such a fascinating story. Why isn't this film better and more interesting? Well, now having watched the documentary, because this guy was so kind of secretive and enigmatic and brilliant and didn't really talk to anyone else about what he was doing, I don't think it's really difficult to make a more engaging version of his life story. I think it's just the nature of Mo Berg, and he probably wouldn't even have wanted anyone to try and figure out what he was doing and how he managed to be a World War II spy in addition to being a major league ball player who spoke like 15 different languages fluently and was just able to, and was a huge studier, went to law school, also became a lawyer. I mean, it's a fascinating story, but unfortunately, the documentary, just like the other feature film, I just wish that there was more for us to really just, I don't know, feel a little more of the drama that had to have been taking place with what this guy did and what he knew. But we really don't see all that much of Mo Berg himself.
I believe there was more in this version, but I recognize that Aviva Kempner ran into a problem. There are not a lot of pictures or videos of Mo Berg.
Right.
So the ones that do exist get replayed a lot. I saw the same footage frequently. And then towards the end, when she's the narrator's describing, went to Italy, went to Switzerland, did this, did that. They actually show footage from movies, from like old 1930s, 1940s spy films or military films, which, all right, that wasn't working at all for me. Another discrepancy I noted is in the Paul Rudd version, Mo Berg was bisexual.
Yes.
In the documentary film,
completely
he
not
is
there.
Very heterosexual.
Womanizer galore. Yes, I made a note of that too, that the documentary completely ignores the sexuality issues that were more than hinted at in the biopic that we saw with Paul Rudd. And so I was, it just made me wonder, like, okay, there had to have been a very conscious decision somewhere along the line where somebody said, if you go down that road, we're not going to participate in this film, or we're not going to give you access to whatever. And so having seen both, it really did kind of color my view, I think, watching this, because I'm just like, okay, what really went on here?
Well, most documentaries don't come out a year after the fictionalized version, so this one has that going against it. But it has, the reason it's coming out in Washington, D.C. is that it has a very strong Washington, D.C. angle. It's opening at the Avalon, which is the art house theater on the north side, the Chevy Chase side of D.C., because there is a lot of old footage of Griffith Stadium, where the Washington Senators played, which is now Howard University, that area. The stadium doesn't exist anymore. And there's a lot of old footage from the city and from the times, and the locals who are interested in that are going to be all over it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, you learn a lot about Mo Berg and the path, his career path, and that he played for the Washington Senators, I think maybe like the one time they won the World Series. And he played with Babe Ruth. And, you know, I mean, he played in the golden era of baseball, but he also was not that great of a player. It's like he was a good player, but he was not a great player. But the part of the story that I found fascinating was really the stuff about how in the 30s, when he went to Japan with what was like this all-star team from the U.S., and somehow he ended up as like a last-minute replacement for the catcher on that team. And I want to know what really happened with that original player who was supposed to go, because the inclination or the implication there is that he was sent to Japan to spy on behalf of the U.S. and to take certain pictures. And so when you think about that now, you just are kind of like, whenever when somebody slips into a high profile, a cool place to be able to go.
The ping pongers who went to China.
And hasn't earned that spot. It just makes you sort of question. But it is a very fascinating story.
He's an interesting dude.
He was an interesting dude. And so the more that people kind of hear about him, the better. But I just feel that there's just always this piece of the puzzle that I still feel is missing.
Well, I don't think anybody saw the first film. I think we were the catcher was a spy. But check this one out. This one is a much better version as a documentary.
I think they complement each other well. I'm actually more interested. I think if you're going to see both at any point, it's going to help you to see the documentary first and then maybe catch a streaming version somewhere, especially if you're a Paul
Rudd
fan. It's a lot of Mo Berg, but I like Paul Rudd. And so as much as the casting seemed a little off at the time, I think
we tore that apart.
I know, but I think if you watch the documentary, it kind of makes you a little less harsh about the feature version that we saw with Paul Rudd. So, you know, I do think that it also shows why it had to have been very difficult to get the catcher was a spy made. And so the spy behind home plate, is is going to be fascinating for also for sports buffs. You know, it's just an interesting way to look back at this one sort of, think about all the other skills and what else might be going on with some baseball players, that sometimes it's not just about what's happening on the field, and you just don't always know what's going on off the field with these guys.
I don't know if there is a contemporary Mo Berg.
I don't know. I don't know.
I'd be surprised.
I don't know. Maybe they're so good at hiding it that we just don't know.
What are we looking forward to next week?
Oh, I think the biggest one I'm looking forward to is probably Rocket Man, the Elton John biopic, even though I've heard mixed reviews about the narrative device that's used to tell the story, that it's not going to be told in the same way as like a Bohemian Rhapsody biopic. But I'm still looking forward to it for the music, as I hated
the narrative arc of the Bohemian Rhapsody. I thought it was the most generic thing I've ever seen in my life.
This is apparently a fan,
fair enough. I don't even want to know. I think Rocketman's the only one I'm going to get to see next week. I'm going on a quick business trip, but on the night I'm away, the Godzilla sequel, King of the Monsters, is premiering. But you're going to have to make a choice, because it's going up against Octavia Spencer in a horror movie.
And that's Ma. And I think I'm leaning now towards Ma over Godzilla.
Good on you.
Because, as you said, I've seen Godzilla before.
Yep.
And I don't think I've seen a Ma horror thriller with Octavia Spencer before. But I'm also catching one other one that's a Netflix original that's going to be coming out in theaters and on Netflix, called Always Be My Maybe, which looks like the chick flick of the group, a romantic dramedy of sorts with these childhood friends reconnecting after having some falling out 15 years earlier, and of course sparks fly, and it's with Ali Wong and Randall Park. And so it actually looks very intriguing.
All right. Well, quick recap. The film that everyone's already seen, Aladdin,
is worth seeing again.
Booksmart, in my opinion, is the best film of the week. It's sharp. It's funny. Congratulations, seniors. Here's your movie.
It's the best adults-only movie.
You gotta qualify it.
Well, come on.
Well, they're all right, fine. Nonfiction is the best French film of the week. How about that?
We. I can probably agree with you on that.
I don't know
But I'm just gonna say that Aladdin is going to far, far, far surpass everything else in Booksmart.
Yes, because you grade movies based on box office.
I'm just far surpassed. Because you got to look at the weekend. You got to look at the time. If it's a family film, it's going to get more play. Yeah. So
families
I'm just saying,
need to go see John Wick. Catch up with John Wick.
Don't do that to them. Family movies, I'd say Aladdin. Everyone else, Booksmart is the better choice this week.
Nonfiction's out there. Meeting Gorbachev. If you're a fan of the man, go learn more about him. And The Spy Behind Home Plate is, man, that's a lot of Mo Berg, but yeah, this is the better version.
And it's not going to be in too many places just yet. It's going to be sort of rolling out in multiple cities nationally and internationally through June, July, and August, I believe.
Yeah, but for DC, get out there and see Mo Berg.
Sure. And support Aviva Kempner.
Oh, very good. All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this argumentative Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.